You are listening to Once a Raider, Always a Raider on the official Raiders Podcast Network. Here's your host, Jerry Knapp.
Hello, once again, Raider Nation. Welcome to another edition of Once a Raider, Always a Raider. I'm your host, Jerry Knack, and I am joined by author, journalist, entrepreneur, Frank Cooney. Frank, how are you?
Doing great. How are you doing today, Jerry?
I'm doing wonderful. Happy holidays to you.
You too.
Well, thank you. Frank, I know you because you were a guy who wrote a lot of draft pick profiles and had a lot to do with getting information out about the NFL draft. You founded the Sports Exchange and NFL Draft Scout. How long have you been involved in covering pro football?
Well, I first started the Hearst paper, which was the Examiner, in 1965, and almost within my first year, I was covering sidebars on the 49ers and Raiders. And I always, I liked football. I was gravitated towards football more than any other sport.
One of the reasons I wanted to have you on the program is another aspect of your career and involvement in pro football is your, it's hard to kind of describe your role, but you have a lot to do with Hall of Fame voting and selection and also championing Raiders who've been nominated. How did you get involved with this? How did you become somebody who has a voice in the Hall of Fame selections?
Well, every franchise has somebody who just represents them on the Hall of Fame selection committee. And a long time ago, in the late 80s, early 90s, when there was a change in who was representing the Raiders franchise, Al Davis nominated me to represent the franchise. And I think that's how the process works. I'm sure the franchise has to agree on who it is. And, you know, I was steeped with the Raiders for a long time, and it's an honor. The reason you want somebody to represent a franchise is that if a player or a candidate comes up, you need somebody simply to present them. And it should be somebody who, you know, who covered them or is knowledgeable about them. So rather than having random people introduce prospects from various teams or franchises, you know, the job then goes to whoever it is that represents that franchise. And I've introduced a lot of Raiders over the last three decades, and it's been an honor. And
when it comes up for a particular team's player to be nominated, how much influence do you have as that franchises or that player coach's champion, so to speak? How does that work?
Well, you know, you never have as much influence as you hope to have.
It's true.
It depends on the candidates. Some of them are extremely well known, and some of them, you know, in your mind and in your heart and in your own analysis, you believe they're Hall of Famers because you've known them intimately and quite well for during their whole careers in many cases, and you know all their positives, but against the matrix of the entire NFL and all franchises going back in history and everybody trying to get players in the Hall of Fame, it's a small bottleneck to get players through. I mean, there's great Raiders that, you know, we've never been able to even get in the room, or took a long time to get in the room. And we're still looking at, you know, right now, Cliff Branch and Jack Tatum, I think, are the historical outliers in terms of time that I know belong in the Hall of Fame. And then, you know, we finally got Tom Flores through part of the bottleneck. And we're looking forward to seeing if we could get her all the way through. Sometimes it's a process, though.
Yeah, it seems that way. And, you know, I think the more time passes, some of the folks who played, you know, 20, 30, 40, even 50 years ago almost get forgotten, especially when you look at, you know, the crop that goes in 5 years after they retire, that kind of that first ballot guy. We're so statistics driven now. Everybody's into fantasy football. And, you know, did the guy throw for 50,000 yards? And how many rings did he win? All these different things. Is that person a television personality? Is that person's name out there all the time? But, you know, I think, you know, and I believe baseball counts character and off the field stuff when it comes to induction in their Hall of Fame. But in football, I think, like, we get so enamored with statistics that we forget about some of these other things, some of these intangibles, some of the off the field impact, the charitable works, but just maybe even just what kind of guy the person was. And I think, you know, in Tom Flores, we have the perfect example, kind of the embodiment of what it means to be this, you know, pillar of the football community.
He's a pillar of society, period. I mean, he creates a high standard for anybody to live up to. He's been a great human being through his whole life. He fought the very difficult fight to stay in football. I mean, he was rejected by the NFL. He was rejected by the CFL. He had shoulder injury coming out of college. And I think he was 17th on a 15-man quarterback roster with the Raiders. My math is off. But he winds up, and he's the first guy to put his hand on Jim Otto's butt and take a snap in Raider history. And that's pretty phenomenal just to get to that stage. And just a marvelous human being and player and knowledgeable football person. Many faceted, you know, attributes that he has. And he's the only category that they have for him is coach. And it's a little limiting because he's been far more than a coach. And there is a category called contributor, but it doesn't fit because they don't allow it. And that's unfortunate because he's been an incredible contributor to pro football. And all the things that he's done as a player, as an assistant coach, as a head coach, as an executive, and as an ambassador of the game. I mean, his qualities are unimpeachable.
Raider Nation, we're talking to Frank Cooney, author, journalist, and Hall of Fame voter or franchise champion for the Raiders. You know, as you were talking about Tom Flores here, let's catch the listeners up a little bit. Tom is a semifinalist for induction for the first time, and there's going to be a cut down to 15 folks, and you started to head in this direction. Tom will be considered as a coach. Now, let's kind of break this down for the listeners. You have players, you have coaches, and you have contributors. With players, they call them the modern era guys, right? So you have the guys who are modern era semifinalists to finalists to actually selected for induction, and that's for players. Is there a time limit on coaches to be considered quote unquote modern era? And go ahead, Frank.
No, I'm sorry. No, there's no time limit on coaches. The seniors category, unless I'm wrong here, is just for players. And then there's a contributors category. These are separate categories. And coaches, I think very unfortunately, they fall in the same category for voters or selectors as players. And it's very difficult for selectors to put everybody in that in the proper perspective there, where you're comparing, you know, on every down. It's difficult to compare a player to a coach. A coach is mean, just the requirements of the jobs are so different. And it's but that's what we have to do. There's three coaches on this ballot of 25 who will be among those that we will vote on to trim down to 15. And there's Don Coryell and Tom are two of them. And Jimmy Johnson is another one. And, you know, when you have to put them up against Ed Reed, how do you do that?
It's an incredibly difficult proposition. And the other thing, too, to understand is with players, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but with players, once their modern era eligibility is over, there's some amount of time that passes, and then they can become eligible for senior committee consideration. But coaches don't work that way.
No, they stay in. They remain as eligible as coaches, and they don't fall in the senior. Geez, the senior job is already tough enough. We've got a gazillion players all bottlenecked there, and like I said earlier, we have a couple of Raiders that are there. Most recently, we had Cliff Branch. As close as you could possibly get to not being voted in when we had a tie a couple of years ago. And we need to get him back there. But the numbers, they start weighing against you because, you know, the people, the prospects keep piling up.
Oh, and they're going to keep piling up.
Yeah, and we don't take a vacation for 5 years. You know, have no further candidates. We're actually hoping that some year, we were hoping it might be 2020, we might have an uncapped year where we can clear the bottleneck of candidates who have reached a certain level often enough. We just need to clear it through on the 100th anniversary of the NFL.
That's a heck of an idea.
But there's no promise there, but
right.
This is all.
Well, I want to make it crystal clear here. Before we kind of talk about Tom Flores' qualifications for the Hall of Fame, if Tom does not go in as a quote-unquote modern-era guy, there is no senior committee for him. If he doesn't go in this way, he's not going to go in.
Like I said, unless I'm mistaken, he remains eligible.
Right.
As a coach. I mean, look, we're still voting for Don Coryell.
Right, but if, you know, like with players, let's say, like, you know, in Ray Guy's situation, he doesn't go in the first way. He had the senior committee almost as a safety net, and Ray gets put into the Hall of Fame that way. That can't happen for Tom or wouldn't happen for Tom.
But Tom would still remain eligible.
Right. He doesn't, like, lose eligibility. But, you know, as you said a moment ago, you there's this bottleneck, and new guys keep coming online every year with eligibility. That, you know, does Tom get forgotten about, squeezed out, that kind of thing? Because, you know, again, each year you're going to have a new crop of eligible candidates.
Yeah. I mean, what we'd like to see ideally, a lot of us on the selection committee, is we'd like to see the coaching category parsed out just like contributors are now. Which is why we got in several owners recently who, you know, weren't getting in when they were put up against players. The coaches, the logic is the coaches are on the field, right? So they fall in the same category as players. But, you know, coaches go across sometimes decades of contribution and at various levels as assistant coaches, head coaches, coach general manager. You know, we have a few of those now. And it's hard to put them, I mean, as much impact and importance as they have on the integrity of the game and the success of their teams, it's hard to put them up against a left guard. You know, all due respect to Gene Upshaw, but it's just difficult, you know?
Yeah, I can imagine so. And, you know, it's almost, you know, it's comparing apples to oranges, really.
Yeah. And we'd like to see, you know, that kind of taken care of so that we could compare coaches to coaches and players to players and contributors to contributors.
Now, you take a look. Let's dive into Tom Flores' qualifications. You know, he was one of the few, I believe the number's 20, players to play in the AFL during the whole decade of its existence, although he missed 62 with tuberculosis. Goes on to become an assistant coach, starts at Buffalo, comes to the Raiders, and then goes on to be a head coach. At total, he wins 4 Super Bowl rings, but as a head coach, he wins 2. Just, you know, his coaching numbers alone with the Raiders are fantastic, but then he has a couple of unfortunate years with the Seattle Seahawks. But in this particular case, you can only look at Tom's coaching record, right? They don't take his playing days into consideration because then it becomes a whole different discussion.
Yeah, they don't take – and, I mean, that's kind of the good news, bad news part of it because in Tom's particular case, it would be obviously very beneficial to take his entire body of work into consideration because he had such a broad, deep impact on the game and the history of the game in the AFL and into the NFL that you know, you'd like to be able to consider it. But technically, if his name comes up in the room, I can't do that. You know, right. I have to talk about him as a coach.
And you know, his playing career as a player, he was a good player, but, yeah. You know, are the numbers there, the impact there for him to be considered as a player?
Yeah, I mean, probably not, but historically, he still had a major impact on the game, on the AFL, and obviously on the Oakland Raiders.
Yeah, I believe he's still fifth, or he finished fifth all time in AFL history in passing yards. not that anybody really, but people like us are going to know that or remember that. But as a head coach, he takes over for the legendary Hall of Famer John Madden, and you know, within a year, he guides the team to a Super Bowl, first wild card team to ever win a Super Bowl. And then a couple of years later in 1983 with Marcus Allen, they win another one. Again, you know, and he guides the team through two work stoppages in 82 and 87. And, you know, he becomes the first Latino head coach to win a Super Bowl. He has been a trailblazer his entire career, entire life, and as you and I spoke yesterday when we were getting set up to do this, you know, overcame immense odds to get to where he ended up and being a part of the fabric of professional football.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't appreciate when he stepped in and took over the team that they think, oh yeah, okay, so he took over John's team and Al was there, and you know the team was going through hell then. There were the move, the court cases, and everything, and that was one of the biggest challenges probably in NFL history to come into a situation so fraught with things that are just in your way, and you have to overcome them. And the team wasn't exactly as settled as people might want to think. If you remember, Al traded Snake and got Dan Pastorini, and that was supposed to be the way of the team. In the meantime, Jim Plunkett was on the bench and recovering from really horrific episodes with New England or Boston and San Francisco, and as things played out, you know, Jim stepped up early in the season and took over, and took this team to a Super Bowl victory. It was an incredible story of achievement and resilience by everybody. But Tom was at the core of this. Tom was the one, you know, the season didn't start very well. Tom wasn't sure how long his career as a coach was going to last a few games into his first season. And it, you know, it turned out pretty damn good.
It sure did, and it became the stuff of legend. The team is widely regarded as a Cinderella story, as is Plunkett. But, you know, like you said, you know, and Tom was the polar opposite of John Madden. John was bombastic and animated, and, you know, Tom was even-keeled and stoic. Perhaps that's why he was able to guide the team through those turbulent times.
Yeah, he didn't add to the frenzy, I'll tell you. He helped set an example, I think. There were some pretty wild characters on that team. History will tell that. And he managed to get them to really function as a Super Bowl winning team. That was a miraculous achievement. Just to say that he took over one team and Al was there, and that's really minimizing, incredibly minimizing the tremendous job that he did to bring that team all the way to the ultimate game. It was incredible.
In your mind, Frank, what makes Tom Flores a Hall of Famer?
He does things the right way and succeeds. And right from how difficult it was from, even though I'm not supposed to talk about being a player, but, you know, how he just kept putting one foot in front of the other, or one bad shoulder in front of the other, and to make it, to just make a roster. And then to overcome tuberculosis and to come back and be traded and then to be an assistant coach and be a very successful assistant coach. That's not to be overlooked. Mm-hmm. And then to take over a team that was in significant turmoil from the top down. I mean, Al was really stirring things up, and it was up to him to make them work. And so he was confronted consistently with these challenges, and he overcame them. He overcame all of them. It's an incredible story of persistence to success, to be successful. And he did it all as a real, an admirable human being. Everything he did. He never sold anybody out that I know of, or, you know, I mean, it'd be hard to find somebody say something bad about Tom Flores. And for a head coach, that's pretty tough.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. Everybody I've talked to on this program since we started it, you know, I've had a lot of his former players on, and nothing but glowing praise for Coach Tom Flores. Now, you're an author of several books, but you get to know Tom and his family pretty well when you co-authored Fire and the Iceman. What else do our listeners need to know about Tom Flores? I mean, he's a great family man and does a lot of charitable works, does a lot of good work in the community. What else is there to know about Tom?
Geez, I don't know. It doesn't end. I mean, he's just, you know, you call him up and he, before you get anything out of your mouth, he wants to know how you're doing. And it's just, and that's when he's, you know, he's, I've known him his whole career almost. And, you know, even when he's really being challenged by situations, he's right there to help you. And his wife, Barbara, is just a gem of a human being. She helped keep the book straight. She was the main editor with, I think I got one rant by John Matuszak in there that she okayed, but otherwise, the book was intended, and this is important to know, a lot of people don't know, the book was intended to show that a person from a family of immigrants can succeed by just doing things the right way. And the book was targeted for young men in, you know, early teens, and that's exactly what it was. If you follow the history of himself and his family before him, how they came into the country on a railroad pump car, whatever you want to call those, in the middle of the night to get away from the raids of the infamous Pancho Villa, and they established themselves and became pillars of the community in Sanger, in that area. And it's a great American story. And Tom, you know, just kept succeeding from the time he picked up a football the first time when he was 11 years old and found an unusual knack at throwing the weird-looking ball. And right up to, you know, his demeanor as an assistant coach and a head coach and an executive and a great broadcaster. I mean, he's I've always felt that I could never really really do him justice. I was honored that he selected me to write the book with him. And no matter, I felt that no matter how hard I tried, it was very difficult to really bring out what a great human being he is.
Well, when you've written as many words in your career as you have, I find that hard to believe. But knowing Tom, you know, is not nearly as well and as long as you have, but, you know, for the better part of 20 years, I actually believe that that's a true statement. I don't know how you completely tell the story of Tom.
Yeah, I mean, the things he's been through and how cool and collected he always remained, and, you know, 9 times out of 10 found success, you know, most often as a Raider. You know, other people would have run screaming into the desert somewhere.
Frank, do you think his time as the head coach of the Seattle Seahawks gets held against him?
Oh yeah, you know, it's analogous to Jordan Seifert as well. They each won 2 Super Bowls and then went on and had misadventures with another organization, and yeah, that gets held against him because. Those people out there aren't voting. They're not Raider fans. They're trying to be, you know, diligent about what they're doing. And when it was first as an executive and then as a coach in Seattle, he had his troubles. Times were changing rapidly then. He happened to move there just at the beginning of free agency. And it was difficult to get your head around all that. And the ownership there, I don't think was very stable at the time, but they were just what he needed. They were talking about moving, and you know. But you know, he did what he could, and in a short period of time, I think it just, you know Tom for all that time, and it for us who know Tom so well, it's easy to just forget Seattle, But everybody, you know, that you can't get everybody to forget Seattle. It happened, and it's a part of, you know, of the entire picture.
Yeah, and you know, it does put a ding in his one loss record, but I do think it's important to note that he had a very, very successful run against other Hall of Fame coaches. I think the only one he had a losing record against was Marv Levy.
You know, I didn't really realize that. I'm not a great statistics guy, but that's funny. Geez, that goes all the way back to, I think they had misadventures at Cal.
Well, What's funny is he got the job at Cal in 1960, and Eddie Ertelatz was passed over for that job, and Ertelatz ends up here with the Raiders as the first head coach. So, you know, I tripped over that little nugget researching the franchise beginnings. Let's talk a little bit about the process when the Hall of Fame, you know, who selects the final or the semifinalists, and how do you trim that from, you know, whatever huge number down to 25, down to 15? Are you physically in a place? How does this all work? What are the mechanics?
Well, it starts with the initial ballot is 100 and I'm not sure. Anybody can nominate a player. You don't have to be a sports writer or anybody can nominate a player. And on the very first ballot, there's between 100 and 200 players. And then it gets slowly whittled down to, the last time we voted, we took it down to 25. And by tomorrow, it will be reduced to 15. And then there's also the senior candidate and the contributor that would be thrown in at the end there. So there'll be 18 at the end who will go into what we call the room. And that's on Super Saturday. There's, I think, 48 selectors. And that now includes two former players. And we vote from first we vote on the contributors and the seniors. It's just yes or no, and you need 80%, and then that's done with. We don't know what happens to that until after the whole thing. So then we start voting on the 15, and we go around the room and talk about each player first, and then we have a vote, and we take it down to 10, and then we take it down to those who make it.
Frank, we were talking about it yesterday when we first connected on the phone. Character, right? We talked a little bit about it a little earlier, but I wanted to talk to you and see what you thought about how important character and doing things the right way. You know, we talk about statistics and rings, but where does character fit into this whole thing of being Hall of Fame worthy?
Well, that's a tricky question, actually, because I think it only matters in as much as the person's character impacted the game. And sometimes that's really tricky. We had a couple of players recently where things they did that weren't on the field were brought in into focus, and unfairly so, I think. So it'd be convenient for me, you know, to say something about Tom's character being an overriding factor right now. But the reality is it's kind of a mulligan stew of things, and whether they say it's official or not, you know, it's in the back of people's minds. And in Tom's case, you know, it should be, geez, if you put him a 12 on a 10 scale for consideration in that aspect. The thing about rings and statistics, I think that's become entirely too much of a crutch for decision making. If all it took to determine who belongs in the Hall of Fame was the amount of jewelry they won in terms of rings or their statistics, then all we need is a scale to weigh the jewelry and a computer to tabulate the statistics, and we don't need selectors. I think the human factor, whether we call it character or whatever we call it, I think the human factor needs to come into play. And what did these people bring to the game? How did they impact the game? There's a lot of players and coaches who had a hellacious impact on the game, positive impact on the game. You know, you can't quantify necessarily. I could think of several players that I just Hall of Fame players who were very, very productive. You know, they didn't have the necessary amount of rings or statistics, but I think they play well into the history of the game, and they 100 years from now, they should be remembered.
One of the things that I like to say, and I stole this, so I will admit to a little plagiarism here, and I'm not the, you know, I can't remember where I first saw it or read it. I'm not the only one who quotes this, that can you tell the story of professional football without this person? And if you can't, that person is Hall of Fame worthy. And I, you know, there's no way you tell the story of professional football without Tom Flores.
Yeah, I happened to be in the room when that phrase first came up, in the room meaning the selection process. And it's been repeated often ever since. And it's an interesting phrase, and it's probably as good a single determination as you can have. You absolutely can't tell the true and complete story of pro football without Tom Flores on several levels. And, you know, if you're going to use that as a determiner, it certainly would demand that he be part of the Hall of Fame so we could tell an accurate story, especially during one of the great eras of football. And he was involved. He was impactful.
That is probably the best way to put it, is that he was impactful, you know, from taking the first snap in Raiders history to being, you know, part of the fabric of the American Football League that shook up the entire landscape of professional football, forcing the merger with the National Football League and basically sculpting professional football as we know it today. I think, you know, from 76 to 83, although it started under John Madden's watch, but to finish in 83, I think that's a dynasty that nobody talks about. Everybody likes to talk, oh, the team of the 60s or the 70s or the 80s. The Raiders bridged the 70s and 80s, and that was a dynasty nobody likes to talk about. And Tom was a key part of that run. Three championships, three Super Bowls at that time in 8 years was unheard of.
Right.
And,
yeah.
You know, and for Tom to lead the team to two of those, I think, is spectacular. You know, Madden led the team to five straight AFC title games, only won one Super Bowl, and had this fantastic winning percentage, and John is in the Hall of Fame as a head coach. I think Tom's credentials very much put him in that category and in that conversation.
Well, Tom definitely, you know, belongs in the conversation, to say the least. And he actually extended what was that era in the 70s where they won five straight, were in the championship game five consecutive times and made it to one Super Bowl. But there were three or four teams during that era that were just phenomenal. And you can only slice that pie one way a season. You know, there's only one Super Bowl team a season, and those games with the Pittsburgh Steelers probably decided four of those Super Bowls.
Mm-hmm.
And Steelers stole, you know, three of them from the Raiders. you know, it's just it's such a remarkable time. And then what Tom did was, you know, everybody looks at that era. Well, Tom actually extended the era, you know, in 80 and 83. So it was no small feat, you know, that he transcended the golden era of football and kept the Raiders in the forefront of the NFL for a few years after. And he deserves his spot and his say in the history of the game.
I agree 100%. It is my pleasure to know Tom Flores. It's also my pleasure to know you, Frank. And it's been way too long since we caught up, and it's been way too long since we've seen each other in person.
Yeah, well, I'll do something about that.
I would definitely agree with that. Frank, I want to thank you for joining me on the Once a Raider, Always a Raider podcast. This has been great.
Thank you very much. It's been a privilege.
Is there anything you'd like to add? Anything we forgot? Any ground we didn't cover?
No, it's I always feel inadequate when it comes to, you know, portraying what a great man and football person Tom Flores is, and so I could babble on here for another hour and still not cover the subject.
Well, I encourage people to read the book "Fire in the Iceman" that you co-wrote with Tom. I think that would give people a great perspective on Tom's life and career.
Right. Great.
Well, I'd like to wish you happy holidays, Frank.
Okay, Darren. And you too.
Well, thank you. That's going to do it for this edition of Once a Raider, Always a Raider. For my guest, noted author, journalist, and historian Frank Cooney, I have been Jerry Knack. We'll talk to you next time. And as always, go Raiders!
Thank you for listening to Once a Raider, Always a Raider on the official Raiders Podcast Network.